It's the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Ian and Dan and Tim are here with me, and now Max joins us for the Showbiz Show, which we do every Friday in the 4 o'clock hour. Hi, Max. How are you?
I am doing fantastic, Paul Harris. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you.
I also like that song that Ian bumped in with, which is probably just some sort of no-name, nothing song that you randomly aired off of YouTube, but I like that band.
No, it's Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah.
Lips Like Sugar.
Very nice.
He went to his random 80s.
New wave.
Yeah,
players.
Sure, yeah. Sure. That's my era, so yeah. I think that's fantastic. Yeah.
Some of us were playing that on the radio.
True.
When it
True.
Was first out.
Yeah. They're so annoying, aren't they, Dan?
These kids today? Are.
When Ian and I say our era, we were actually kids. You guys probably played that stuff. We didn't, so.
Mm-hmm. It was nice working with you, Max.
Yeah.
All right. Great. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Good night, everybody.
Let's get to the movies this weekend. And one of the big movies that's creating an enormous amount of buzz is the new Christopher Nolan movie, which is called Dunkirk.
Yes.
You and I both saw it at a screening earlier this week.
Actually, side by side.
That's correct.
You, thankfully, moved over one seat so I could sit next to you.
Well, that's because the screening was packed.
Yes.
Christopher Nolan draws a crowd.
He does.
Now, we've had several movies recently that were based on historical events that most Americans didn't know anything about. For instance, Hidden Figures, I guess, would be one of the best examples of that. And Dunkirk is a story from World War II that most Americans don't know about because it took place before the United States was involved in World War II.
That's right, before we thought it was important for us to get involved with that.
This took place in the spring of 1940 when German forces had surrounded more than 400,000 Allied troops, mostly British and French, in the French port city of Dunkirk, which is right across the English Channel from England. The troops were trapped on beaches, the English Channel at their backs. The water there was too shallow for big Navy vessels to get in. So Winston Churchill called upon citizens of England who owned smaller private boats, what they called, quote, the little ships of England, to come to the rescue. And that's what this movie is essentially about.
So it's a story that is very famous over in Britain.
Yes.
And the UK.
An inspirational story to them, even though it's not a story. It's not a story of a victory. It's a story of a retreat.
Yes.
But it's actually the story of a rescue, which was what made it, I think, positive for them. And, yeah, it did become an important part of British history. Now, I have a feeling that you and I are going to disagree on this movie.
Most likely.
I liked
my earlier reviews. Yes,
no, I haven't heard anything you said about it.
I didn't like this film at all. But you and I watched it side by side. Let's talk for a moment, if you can entertain me, Mr. Paul Harris,
okay,
about Christopher Nolan.
Okay.
I think that he is an important filmmaker. I think he's a dynamic filmmaker. But he's made about 8 or so movies, and I find myself right down the middle. 4 of them I didn't like. 4 of them I liked.
Okay.
So I'm not one of these Christopher Nolan fanboys. I feel like the positive reviews we've felt for this film have come from people loving Christopher Nolan. And I wonder in about 10, 20, 30 years if that will still be the case.
Well, I think I'm with you because I really liked Memento.
Absolutely.
I really liked Inception.
Yes.
And I really liked 2 of the 3 Batman movies he did, Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises Again.
And also Prestige with Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale.
That was okay.
Okay. I liked that one, too. The ones that I didn't like, though, Insomnia, which was a remake, but I still didn't like it.
Interstellar.
Interstellar. Whoa. With that whole third act is just god-awful.
Yes.
He's made some bad movies, and I am not a Christopher Nolan fanboy, so to speak.
Okay.
And going to see the film, I thought, well, you know, I hope I like this. Now, my only insight into Dunkirk was actually a film from 2007, a film that I think is a masterpiece. It's by director Joe Wright, who's also British, and it's called Atonement. Now, it's based on the same book by Ian McEwan, which is a great, great book, and it's about deceit in interpersonal relationships. But at some point, one of the characters, played by James McAvoy, goes to fight in this fracas, and he's on the beach at Dunkirk, and it's about a 5 to 7 minute unbroken shot that Joe Wright shows us of this. And being an American, I had no idea about this, and it is incredible and devastating. And I kept thinking about that, watching Dunkirk, going, that 7 minutes was maybe better than this entire
No.
Oh, wow.
We're really going to disagree on this.
That's totally fine.
No. Well, and speaking of reviews real quick, I saw this story a couple days ago about Rotten Tomatoes is, of course, one of the biggest movie review websites. And before the movie is out, it gives a score on what the critics that have seen it already. And it had a 100%, which is very rare for Rotten Tomatoes, mm-hmm. until a gentleman by the name of Harvey S. Carton gave it a grade of C. And would you like to know what publication he reviews movies for?
Mm-hmm.
CompuServe.
What?
CompuServe.
If I can digress about aggregators, wow. I don't like Rotten Tomatoes. I don't like Metacritic. I don't like aggregators because of two reasons. Number one, assigning an arbitrary number to a work of art makes no sense to me. That's like saying the Mona Lisa is a 6. What does that mean? It doesn't actually tell you anything about that work of art. Number two, there's about 30 or so critics that annually have their work appraised for Rotten Tomatoes. How do you become one of those critics? Can you apply to Rotten Tomatoes? Can you, Ian, do a body of work and apply to Rotten Tomatoes? Will you be accepted? Will people understand what you want to say about the film? If I give a mixed review to a film, like Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which I liked a whole lot, and we'll talk about that, but it has some bad things too, so that would be a mixed review, but they give it a 49%, so it's rotten. Well, is that fair? I understand it's easy for people to go to a website and go, oh, 49%. What does that mean? It means nothing. It cannot replace actual criticism. Now, you brought up Roger Ebert. Lots of things about Roger Ebert I did not agree with. Mulholland Drive, I think, is a masterpiece. Probably David Lynch's best film. Ebert hated it. Lynch loved the review so much, he had it printed up on poster boards and had it displayed while the movie was playing, because mm-hmm. he thought, here's a guy who misunderstood my movie so much and my fans will get it. Same thing with me. People who've listened to Max and Movies since 2004 know that I don't like certain things. I don't like Westerns. So if I give a Western a bad review, they go, well, Max doesn't like that. That's the power in knowing your reviewer.
Mm-hmm.
An aggregator can never replicate that. So to digress a little bit, I don't care that Dunkirk has gotten overwhelmingly good reviews. I'll give it a negative review. And after Bo Harris tells you why you should see it, I'll tell you why you shouldn't.
Whoa.
No, that's fine.
That's good.
We're allowed to disagree. That's,
yes,
that's what
absolutely.
This hour is all about.
I just thought it found
CompuServe?
Yes, that's what I that was my, that's what I took from that story. Is it really?
That was my internet portal.
The 100% streak broken by the reviewer from CompuServe.
I didn't even know the CompuServe was still around. That was my ISP in 1986 when I got my first Tandy 1000 computer. I had a CompuServe account.
It was either that or Prodigy, right? I think you only had two choices.
Yeah, I don't even think Prodigy was around yet when
I think CompuServe was the first.
73030,2227 at CompuServe.com was my email address. You didn't even have a name then. You had a number with a comma in the middle.
Yeah, you
Paul
can't
Harris,
put commas
if
in an email.
You can address. Tell the audience why they should see Dunkirk.
Okay. I told you what the story's about. The movie doesn't tell you all that much about what the movie is, and I like that. I like that it doesn't have all this lame voiceover narration. There's not a lot of exposition. You're introduced to some characters who, frankly, in many of the scenes can be interchangeable. But the movie is, here's the important thing you do need to know before you go see this movie. It is told from three points of view. Nolan calls it part one, part two, and part three, and each of them has a name. Part one is the men on the beach in Dunkirk by the hundreds of thousands who are essentially waiting to be rescued over the course of a week. And at the same time, you've got German dive bombers coming and shooting at them, and they've got the Germans knocking on the door in this little French village, and there's nothing they can do. There's nothing to eat, there's nothing to do, except stand in a line and wait, hopefully, for somebody to come and rescue them. That part is called the mole, even though it's not a mole in the common spy sense. The mole is the pier they have to stand on that shoots way out into the water, which is the only way that a Navy vessel could come and pick them up. So there are thousands of them standing on this pier as it juts out into the ocean, and they're waiting. So that's one point of view. Another point, and that's over the course of a week. The next point of view is of the small boat owners, I told you, who are going across the English Channel to Dunkirk to help. That point of view is told over the course of a day. And then the third point of view is that of a British Spitfire pilot who is trying to shoot down the German dive bombers who are attacking everything, and the time span there is an hour. Now, these three things overlap, and sometimes they do have the same stories in them. The timelines are malleable in Christopher Nolan's world as they are in many of his other movies.
To explain to the audience, you might be watching a nighttime scene on the beach because 3 days have passed, and all of a sudden it's daytime again in the Spitfire cockpit because it's only been 20 minutes.
Right. He's up for an hour.
I will say that's a little confusing for the audience.
It is a little bit, which is why I say you need to know this before you go see the movie. And it took me a while during the movie to figure out what was going on. The cinematography really puts you into the middle of the action. And the action in this thing, once it gets started, it never stops. And the Hans Zimmer score never stops either. It keeps the mood tense, and it is intense throughout this entire movie. In fact, I think it has the third most intense war scenes I've ever seen in a movie. Number one, of course, will be the opening of Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, yeah.
Number two would be Mel Gibson's movie Hacksaw Ridge, which had an extended scene in battle that was right up there with Saving Private Ryan. And in this, you see the harrowing nature of war, with the men on the beach being attacked by the dive bombers, with the men in the planes trying to fight each other, with the men who are trying to get onto a ship, and here come the bombs that are dropping around them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not giving anything away here. I'm just telling you, this thing is harrowing, and it's intense. There are some actors in here whose names you might know, like Kenneth Branagh and Mark Rylance and Tom Hardy. You don't need to know who's in this thing. In fact, most of the players who play the soldiers from the very beginning, they're interchangeable. One of them is Harry Styles, who used to be in One Direction. I don't know why he was cast in this. It's not like you're going to get teenage girls to go see this British war movie about something that happened in 1940.
They probably will.
If they're expecting to see Harry Styles in the One Direction form, they're going to be seriously disappointed. But all of those are kind of interchangeable. But none of that matters because the story is so compelling. Most people don't know it, and like Saving Private Ryan, even though it's not about a glorious victory, it is so compelling and so interesting to watch. I was drawn in completely. Now here to tell you why it sucks, Max.
This is probably Christopher Nolan's worst film. I will say that Chris Nolan, as you pointed out, was dealing with time and dealing with expectation with time. He's done it with to great effect with Memento, which, of course, is a story told in reverse, or Inception, which is a story that collapses upon itself. I don't know why he chose to do that with Dunkirk. It makes no sense, and it keeps the audience, to me anyway, at arm's length. You mentioned the greatest and most harrowing war movies. For me, the one that pops to mind, besides Saving Private Ryan, of course, number one, would be Full Metal Jacket in that second half when the sniper is taking them off one by one. Mm-hmm. Because you've gotten to know those people and you understand their backstories. In Dunkirk, I didn't know who was who. You've said a couple times now that the characters are interchangeable. I think that's a detriment to the film. When somebody drowns towards the end, I wasn't sure who drowned. I had to ask somebody who just died.
Okay,
also,
let me just get in here on that.
Sure.
You know the scenes where you see hundreds of these soldiers, thousands of them lined up? They're just lined up. They're just waiting. Especially the ones on the pier, but also the ones on the beach. That's the uniformity of being in the military. Everybody has to be interchangeable. You don't have to know the backstory of each person who's in there. They all wear the same uniform. They all have the same gun. They all have the same helmet. They're all in the same circumstance. They all have to work together to figure out what it is. It's not about individuals.
I understand in the wide shots when you have all the helmets and basically the TIE fighters are coming in because the screams of those Spitfires are very much what George Lucas brought us back in the 70s, of course, based on that kind of warship anyway. And I love the sound in this film is incredible.
Yes.
And it really affects you. So I get that. But when you want the audience to be invested in what's happening, the uniform and the anonymity of the troops, to me, doesn't work because I don't have something that I can key into. You mentioned Harry Styles. People have been saying, oh, he's going to be a great actor. You know what? Plenty of pop stars, from Frank Sinatra to Justin Timberlake, have become decent actors. And maybe that's in Harry Styles' future. I can't tell that from this movie because he's just the angry young man.
Yes.
And quite frankly, his role goes in one direction. Huh? What? Huh? Come on, somebody.
I see what you did there.
Thank you so much.
Wow.
to me, this film is playing a different aspect ratio. So you can see it in 70mm, like Hateful Eight from Tarantino. You can see it in IMAX.
See it in IMAX.
I think it's a pretty
big war movie.
It is.
This is not going to be good on your phone in 2 years.
I agree with that. But in 2 years, I can't ever imagine watching this film again.
Oh.
If this film is on TV or a friend of mine says, hey, I've got this on Blu-ray, let's watch Dunkirk, I will never watch this movie again. I was not invested in any character. I did not care about any kind of outcome because the film didn't give me the stakes. Tom Hardy, I don't know what he has in his writer about, or his contracts, about obscuring his face and masking his voice.
Like
he's done this,
Bane?
Not just with Bane, but in lots of other roles, too. And he's going to be Venom pretty soon for the Marvel Universe. And
he's just basically doing this as far as the pilot of the film.
I really, really strongly dislike this movie. Everything that I had an issue with, though, you've seemed to like, including Hans Zimmer. And I love Hans Zimmer. Oh, my God. His Lion King score, incredible. Inception, groundbreaking. Obviously, everybody's ripped that off. The guy is doing concerts right now. He was at Glastonbury. He's doing festivals. I would love to see him. His Man of Steel score is next level. I hated his score for this. Mm. I thought it insisted upon itself. It was too in your face. I didn't like it at all. So it seems like we have a disagreement, which is totally fine, and that's why we're both here. I cannot implore the audience enough to please stay away from Dunkirk.
Okay. I will tell you one bad thing about this movie. It's very British, which means it's hard sometimes to understand the accents. If you were watching this on your home TV, you'd probably turn on the closed captioning so you could understand them. But here's the thing about that. The dialogue in this movie doesn't matter. You talk about not being able to hear Tom Hardy. He's not saying anything you have to hear.
Nothing in the movie
matters. Everything that goes on in the movie is compelling to watch and to listen to, but the dialogue is pretty much immaterial.
Can I say one positive thing?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Mark Rylance.
How good is this guy?
Not an actor that I was familiar with before Spielberg's Bridge of Spies.
Me too.
And I feel bad saying that because I know he'd done a lot of work, but I had not paid attention as Spielberg had. And of course, he won Best Supporting Actor for that movie because he was that good as the spy in that film. BFG. My kid has watched, he read the book from Roald Dahl. He watched the movie. He loves that movie. Mark Rylance is absolutely the best thing about this film.
Yes.
He is the only one who gives you any sense of place and purpose in this film. And I just wanted to give him some accolades.
He plays the owner of one of these small boats that goes as part of the rescue.
Decides to go to rescue them.
Yeah. Here's what I thought as I was walking out of the intensity of this movie. When your grandfather won't tell you stories about World War II, these are the kind of stories that he has in his memory that he will not tell you because they're so damn harrowing. The movie is an hour 45. To me, that's just the right length. I give it an 8.5 out of 10. I know you don't like quantifying things, Mr. Rotten Tomatoes.
Thanks so much.
But you probably give it a 1.
No. Nolan obviously knows what he's doing as far as crafting a film. I can disagree as far as the day is long, but I will give this... I'll give this a 4.
Okay.
How about that?
All right.
Whoa. That's way higher than I would have thought.
Do you remember earlier this year I reviewed a movie, another English movie called Their Finest?
Yes, absolutely.
Which has Bill Nye.
You liked that one.
And I liked it a lot. And part of the plot of that was people trying to make a movie. During World War II, the British Film Board wanted to make movies that would rouse the British public. And so they wanted to tell the Dunkirk story. A few years later.
You gave that a 7 or 8, right?
I gave it a 7.5 at the time. And that's a movie that you should see as well. It's called Their Finest.
Have you seen Atonement?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, next week I'm going to bring you my copy.
Okay.
Because 10 out of 10 I think is a masterpiece. And it has, a 7 to 5 minute scene, unbroken at Dunkirk. Incredible.
All right. We will have more movies to review for you when we come back with the second half of the Showbiz Show here on the Big 550 KTRS. Continuing along with the showbiz stuff here on the Big 550 KTRS, Max and I have a deep disagreement over Dunkirk, which is opening up this weekend. There's also a new movie called Girls Trip, which is the African-American version of Rough Night, In other words, it's four women who've known each other for a long time who get together for a reunion and they go out. Although I understand no stripper died in the making of this movie.
Now, I didn't see either one of those, actually.
Neither did I.
Okay.
So that's our review of Girls Trip.
Can I say, by the way, our deep argument over Dunkirk is one of my favorite things that you and I have done. I like when critics get together and can both give legitimate reasons why they didn't enjoy a certain film. That, of course, was the whole deal between Siskel and Ebert, and you don't get that anymore. Everybody is in some sort of echo chamber, and everybody has to be uniform, not just with Rotten Tomatoes, but anybody you see on YouTube, you know, they're alone, they're doing their own thing. That was what was genius about Siskel and Ebert. That was a PBS producer who decided to put them together because they didn't know one another. They were competing newspapers.
Right.
And yet they came together and they had a begrudging respect. And we don't have that anymore. So
no, or you have the people that get angry and tell somebody their opinion is wrong.
I mean, obviously, Paul's opinion is wrong, but it's still nice to be on the show.
That's fine. The third movie that's opening this weekend, which will only be playing in the art houses, is called The Journey, which is the gripping account of two men who, speaking of disagreeing, these guys actually literally hated each other. In 2006, amidst the decades-long conflict that went on in Northern Ireland, remember when there were bombings in Belfast? And I mean, the war in Northern Ireland went on for 30-plus years. This movie is about a real-life incident involving a guy by the name of Ian Paisley, who is a very relieved anniversary. And so he asks if they would mind if he went home, and the Martin McGuinness character says, well, if you go, I have to go with you, at least to the airport and on the plane, because that's our agreement here in making these negotiations. Everything one side gets, the other side has to get the same. And besides, you wouldn't want to be traveling alone in this part of the country when some people might think you're the enemy, we have to blow you up.
Hmm.
That's a pretty good setup for a movie.
It's pretty
back to where the meeting had been taking place, and John Hurt is talking to the driver of that car and explaining to him the historic importance of this dialogue.
So
and
the
why
driver
he has to,
is us.
Yes.
He's the audience.
Exactly. And why he has to instigate conversation between the two of them. And there's an actor playing Tony Blair, who was then the prime minister, and an actor playing Gerry Adams, who was then the head of Sinn Féin, the militant wing of the IRA.
Too bad.
And you have all of that going on, distracting from the story. And here's why it's bad. The two actors playing these two men are great actors. One of them is Colm Meaney.
Oh, sure.
Who has been in pretty much every great English and Irish movie, going back to The Van and The Snapper and
Commitments.
The Commitments and all those things. And he was even on a Star Trek series for several years.
Absolutely, yes.
And the other one, the Englishman, is played by Timothy Spall, who I didn't know until I saw him in Denial last year.
Harry Potter as well.
He's in the Harry Potter movies. And they're both so good in this, you don't want to cut away from them. Why, if you're making a movie with those two actors, wouldn't you just say, put them in a car?
Let's do it.
Put a lock down the camera. You don't need close-ups. Just show these two guys going at it. But the director didn't have faith in that. I think if you were just in the car, it would turn into a very dramatic version of the Trip movies. You know, the ones that Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon do?
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one of those coming out soon they did the Trip, and they did the Trip to Italy, and the next one's the Trip to Spain.
They're fantastic.
Which will probably also include more Michael Caine impressions. Now, these two guys arguing over reuniting Ireland, very important work that they're trying to do, which we all know eventually got accomplished, not reuniting Ireland, but stopping the fighting after 30 years. They're not going to do Michael Caine impressions because they're too intense, but there's fascinating stuff going on between them. But this movie misses the boat big time. I'm giving it a 5 out of 10 because I like the two leaders. It's called The Journey. Frankly, it's not worth your journey to the theater to see it.
Mm.
Then I also, speaking of journeys, I have to talk about Le Ride. We had Phil Kogan on the show, about 4 or 6 weeks ago? The guy from The Amazing Race, right before The Amazing Race finale. And he was on to talk about this documentary he made a couple of years ago with his wife. It's about the 1928 Tour de France, which Phil Kogan and his friend Ben decided to recreate, riding 1928 steel bicycles with only one gear around the perimeter of France like these New Zealanders did in 1928. And the movie tells both stories, the story of what happened in 1928 and what happens to Phil Kogan and this guy Ben who's riding with him, plus their support crew, as they go around France on roads that in 1928 were gravel roads. Today, they're highways, which you can't go on with a bicycle. So they had to find what their route would be. They are on these bicycles all day, every day. One of their rides, where they have to go up and down the Pyrenees, the mountains, they rode that day for 23 straight hours.
Is this a streaming film, or can I see it on the big screen?
It is. They showed it last night at the AMC Crevecoeur 12. That was the only time it's going to be shown in St. Louis.
Okay.
I'm mentioning it here today because when it is eventually streaming, or you can buy it from iTunes or Amazon, it's worth watching, because Phil is always entertaining, as he is on the Amazing Race. Also, because the cinematography in this, you see the French countryside. I mean, I don't care if you've gone to France, you've never seen it like this. So beautiful as they go up and down these mountains and across the countryside. It's fantastic. It has very funny parts. It has very historic parts about the guys who were in it in 1928. And the effort that these two guys, maniacs, to try to recreate this 3,000-mile bicycle ride in less than a month. Are you kidding me?
Ridiculous.
Up and down the Pyrenees and then up and down the Alps? Oh, it's remarkable. It's called Le Ride.
The Tour de France is going on.
Yeah, this Sunday.
Wrapping up this week.
This Sunday is the finale of it.
Yeah.
In that Tour de France in 1928, something like 160 guys started, 40-something finished.
Wow. Oh, wow.
That's how brutal it was. And then there's something else on Netflix that you wanted to mention.
That's right. Castlevania is on Netflix now. For people who grew up in the 80s, they know the Castlevania franchise has been around for about 25 years right now, and it's been on different platforms. When I first heard Netflix was going to adapt it, I thought, well, that's a horrible idea, because you couldn't possibly have the budget to recreate the story about Dracula and his son and all this kind of... Well, they've animated it, and so that takes care of any kind of budget issues. Also, they got Warren Ellis, who is a comic book writer, who's a great writer, to adapt it, and I've watched the 4 episodes. It's about an hour and a half if you want to stream the whole thing. It's really worth watching, and because of a friend that you had here in studio, Mr. Paul Harris, I got the executive producer, Mr. Fred Seibert, to join me on the Maxim Movie Show. You can hear it tomorrow night on Maxim Movies, 10 p.m., talking all about Castlevania, which is now streaming on Netflix, which, by the way, is worth checking out.
Okay. Speaking of Netflix, they have a new series called Ozark that is out today. I think since we have so many people who go to Lake of the Ozarks on a regular basis, you may be interested in this show, which stars Jason Bateman and Laura Linney and Issei Morales. That's a pretty good cast.
Yeah.
Bateman plays a money launderer who, for some reason, has to move his family from Chicago to the lake to convince his angry drug cartel bosses that he can still do the job. I don't know what anything I just said means, because I haven't seen this series, which just came out today, but I've read a couple of reviews, and they say it's terrible.
No.
Yeah.
But Laura Linney, though.
I know.
Normally, she's
great. We've talked about what a great actress she is, about how she makes bad choices about some of the projects she gets involved in.
All right.
And Jason Bateman has been pretty good in a lot of movies lately. But I'm going to skip this one. If you go to the lake on a regular basis and you want to see if this movie gets the skee ball palaces and the tattoo parlors right.
Senior Frogs.
Yeah. And Pistols Plus and some of the other places. You might want to check it out for that. And then I want to mention one other show that is going to be on Showtime tomorrow night. It's actually a movie called Risk, a new documentary by Laura Poitras, who won an Oscar for her Edward Snowden documentary, Citizen Four.
Yes, which is
3 years ago. It was.
You watched that, right?
Yes, I did.
Phenomenal.
It was the best documentary of the year and deserved to win the Oscar, which it did. In Risk, she gets extraordinary access to Julian Assange, who is the man behind WikiLeaks. I don't know how Laura Poitras gets in with all these people who you would think want to keep their lives as secret as possible.
Maybe you say, hey, I did Citizen Four.
Yeah, but how does she get in with Edward Snowden, and how does she get in with Julian Assange?
Yeah, right.
The stories actually overlap in this movie a little bit.
Okay.
But Poitras keeps her camera trained on him and his inner circle as they plot to gather and release all these secret documents from around the world. They also speak out against online censorship and overzealous data gathering. There's a remarkable scene in there with a WikiLeaks editor who's on a panel of people speaking in Egypt during the Arab Spring, And they're all talking. There's one guy from a phone company. There's one guy from an internet service provider. And they're all talking about how they were there to support the revolution. And this guy from WikiLeaks says, no, no, you weren't. You, Mr. ISP, you blocked Twitter for 98% of the users in Egypt so they couldn't be have access to the revolution. And you, Mr. Phone Company, you said you supported it, but you actually exploited the people who were involved. He's saying this right in front of them. It's an amazing, real scene from this documentary.
I would have one question. People who have an issue with Julian Assange
yes.
and with his personal issues,
yes.
does this film go into hero worship with him?
Interesting you should mention that, because throughout the movie, Poitras does some voiceover things where she says, production journal. And at one point in the movie, she says, this is not the movie I thought I was going to make. She thought she was making it about WikiLeaks. It turns into a movie focusing on Julian Assange's accusations
Absolutely.
By some women in Sweden of sexual assault and rape. And then he has to fight the attempts to extradite him. From
Which
England
you don't
to
know
Sweden.
At the time, is it because of WikiLeaks or is it because of actual foul deeds?
That's what you don't know.
Right.
But she keeps her camera trained on him, and they go through this whole thing. And Assange is an unbelievably paranoid guy. There's a scene in the movie where he has to leave the building he's in, and he goes out into the woods with one of his lawyers and Poitras' camera for some reason. And while he's talking quietly, almost whispering to his lawyer, he hears like a twig crack. Maybe 10, 20, 30 yards behind him. You don't know. But his head swivels 180, and he looks around, and he says, I don't know what that was. And his lawyer says, it was probably a bird. Don't worry. He says, no, I think there are two men over there, and they're watching and listening to us.
Oh.
And he asks Laura Poitras to take her camera and go out there.
Oh.
And she points the camera around, and is like, there's no one there.
Wow.
But that's who this guy is. Now, I will say, in his line of work, paranoia probably comes with the game, because you know what? The whole world is after him. But he also comes off, particularly about the sexual assault and rape things, as an arrogant ass. There's another scene with another one of his lawyers who's saying, you know, Julian, you need to be more careful about what you say in public.
I get making up, damning evidence about somebody to discredit them when they're doing what he's doing. But he doesn't seem to have handled any of that with grace.
No, and in fact, he actually says some misogynistic and anti-gay stuff in this conversation with his lawyer. And he says, you know, I would never say that publicly. I would only say it privately. And I'm thinking to myself, there's a camera on you from a documentarian. It's kind of like the scenes in Wiener, where you
right.
think,
yes.
why would these
yeah.
people say this with a camera
How much
pointed at them
go?
In the room?
Yeah.
So this thing is going to air tomorrow night on Showtime for the first time, and then it'll be on for the next month. It played at the Cannes Film Festival and made some noise last year. It is not as good as Citizen 4. In that movie, Snowden comes off as a hero for revealing the privacy-busting concerns of our government. In this one, Assange comes off like an arrogant ass.
Well, again, maybe that's not what the filmmaker thought she was going to make.
That's
she thought
right.
she was going to make another Snowden-type film. I mean, Snowden, love him or hate him, is a whistleblower. And you can have issues with that if you want, but
yep.
he's a whistleblower. Assange, he almost is a mercenary. And I feel like you can't quantify that as far as what kind of person he's going to be.
You can look at this movie tomorrow night on Showtime and think of it for yourself. I'll tell you this. Citizen 4 was on my best movies of 2014 list. This one will not.
Mm.
That's our showbiz stuff for this week here on the Big 550 KTRS.